I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Finished with your summer reading list and looking for a new page-turner? With the kids finally returning to school, are you planning some quiet time with a good book? This hour, our book doctors return with all the latest reads, whether it's following a young man who answers a help wanted sign in the window of a 24-hour bookstore, or solving the mystery of a series of international murders. There's something for everyone. Get ready to jot down some great recommendations as we get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the book doctors are in the house to run down some good reads as this summer comes to a close, which officially happened this morning at 6:15 a.m. when my new high school freshman woke up to catch his 6:50 a.m. bus. Remember all that talk about how high school kids need their sleep? But that's a topic for another day. Today we're talking books, and lots of good books at that, as our book doctors have come packing with lots of good recommendations, including a new play, which has been recorded with voices belonging to people named George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Martin Sheen. Our book doctors today are Katie Stover, who is Director of Reader Services for the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. Katie, good morning.
Good morning.
Author and critic Jeffrey Ann Gowdy is also here. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
Barstow School Senior Dean and English Department Chair Mark Luce is here. Mark, how are you?
Doing just fine.
And writer and blogger Grace Suh is also here. Grace, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
How's the book reading? How's everybody doing?
Great. Overwhelmed.
Busy. Overwhelmed.
Good reading.
Too many books coming into the library these days?
Constantly.
Yeah? Yeah, it's just too much, eh? Well, Katie, why don't you kick us off here with a book by Robin Sloan.
Oh, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore.
Yes.
This is a book that I picked up at BEA last June.
BEA is?
Book Expo America.
Yes.
And I loved this book. I termed it a combination of Night Circus meets Shadow of the Wind, and they both wave hello to Ready Player One. All of Night Circus and Ready Player One were big books for last year.
This is Mr. Penumbra's
24-Hour Bookstore.
Yeah.
And it's a very it's a deft mix of print and the print and electronic worlds. It's really hip. It's about a recently downsized web and graphic designer, Clay, and he takes a part-time job at an obscure San Francisco bookstore, and it's run by an otherworldly and rather old-world mannered gentleman, Mr. Penumbra. And the bookstore is patronized by a very unusual clientele, the Secret Biblio Society, and they check out the books from the bookstore. Sort of shades of a library there. And they have bookstore member cards. They don't purchase anything from the special collection, but every once in a while they buy something that they want. And then they return the books when they feel like it, at their leisure. And Clay's only job is to work the graveyard shift and then fetch the books and then record the entire transaction, not just what book the patrons take with them, but what they look like, what's the conversation, what's their attitude, what's their demeanor, what do they say in this huge logbook. And so in an effort to just sort of pass the time and bring the business end of this bookstore into the I age, Clay creates a data visualization program, and he tracks the bookstore's customers' borrowing patterns. And don't worry, folks, your library is not doing that. But then he discovers that there's this secret formula to the way the books are arranged on the shelves, and there's some secret that each of these patrons are trying to figure out. And because he did all this with a computer program, this cabal is now trying to destroy the bookstore and the bookstore's owner, Mr. Penumbra. So this is like a really hip literary Easter egg hunt, and it'll appeal to fans who of careful plotting, quirky characters. It's a real page turner, and it really asks the question: which is more immortal, print or electronic?
Hmm.
So a literary mystery that really speeds along.
A pretty solid recommendation. That book, again, Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore by Robin Sloan. What do you know about Robin Sloan?
Not much. I believe this is a first novel. It's the cover isn't anything to write home about. It's black, and you can see it's sort of got that that computer's about to turn on sort of symbol in a circle, except that it's all pages of a book. You're looking down at a book.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a feeling this is the galley copy. I have a feeling the cover's going to be a lot more eye-popping because this really is the kind of book that will appeal to teenage boys, any teen reader. It really moves along very quickly.
Is the book out?
It's coming in October.
In October.
And it's getting a nice big push. October 2nd, look for Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore.
So if you're tearing out to buy it today, you might have to wait a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Probably be out 2 weeks before that.
You think?
Oh,
let's hope.
Usually. Well, yeah. Usually they're out 2 weeks before their actual pub date.
What's the comparison to Night Circus? I'm just curious.
It's the world building. And Night Circus is one of those books that you liked it for different things. It's the intricate plotting. Mm-hmm. All these elements fit together. I barely scratched the surface with the plot. I gave you the overlay.
Wow.
I didn't go into what kind of part Google plays in this book because they play a pretty sizable role. They take all this information, dump it into a program, and they send it out to all the computers of the world. And that's just a minor plot point. But
it's always interesting to me.
Sounds like a pension book.
Yeah,
like there's some sort of conspiracy and secret sort of literary society of some sort.
It is. It is like that.
Oh, would that were it true?
Well, you guys come in sometimes.
Really. Yeah, all the literary conspiracy going on.
You guys come in here sometimes and you mention these books by first-time authors that are so good, which always floors me to come out of the gate with a book that draws such positive rays from you, Katie. I always wonder, but you don't hear about them 5-10 years down the road. Like, can they duplicate the initial success or not? How often are they one-trick ponies and then that's their book, and it's a great accomplishment, and that's it.
Harper Lee
syndrome. It used to be that authors had 3 or 4 or 5 books to sort of craft that reputation. But anymore, if you don't sell on your first one,
you're done.
You're done.
Mid-list
authors have disappeared.
And that means what? I mean, authors
who have like 4 or 5 novels, and they're mostly in print, and they the publisher pays them to kind of keep them working.
I mean, the university presses have taken over that role, really,
but not
more
so much
than the commercial
for fiction.
Yeah, but not for fiction.
Well, that's true. Yeah,
although it's really
point.
Interesting. My second book is a book. I'll talk about it later. The Art Forger by B.A. Shapiro. This is a book that's being positioned like a debut novel, but no one's saying that. And it's a mid-list author who was dropped from her publishing house, and Algonquin picked her up. But I could talk about that later.
Oh,
yeah,
I think you have to be very careful.
But if you think about the writers that we know and revere from the past, like Saul Bellow or John Updike, or these are writers who didn't take off until their fourth book, their fifth book.
That's interesting.
Right. Ann Tyler. Their first 3-4 books did not sell well, were barely reviewed, and then they took off. Mm. And that is almost impossible to do anymore.
I think it takes – I tend to think that, writers simply get better with age.
Yeah.
You read – I really like –
I get better looking with age. Same thing.
Sure. No.
Yeah.
You take someone like Daniel Woodrell, who was certainly would fall in that mid-list, used to fall in that mid-list category. In his first 3 books, kind of detective bayou stories, and they got some attention, and a lot of authors were like, oh, this guy can really write. Mm-hmm. But even after his second or third, or so I guess his fifth or sixth book, his other books are already out of print. And it takes the Ride with the Devil and Winter's Bone for him to actually sell books and make money.
And Cormac McCarthy, the same thing.
Cormac McCarthy's exact same way.
So are you saying, Mark, that basically these days either you hit a home run with your first book or chances are you're not going to be around for a while?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have a lot of writer friends who have been dropped. And I think that you have to have a book that kind of has a gimmick and can be easily summarized and sound sensational. Not to say that these are bad books, Night Circus and all of these books, but a plot that can be told and it zips along and it can be sold. And if it's a book that relies on character or language, you're going to have a hard time.
Yes.
Like there are guys.
Which is taking a whole set of books off the list.
That's right. The books that you know and love the most.
Well, you take someone. I mean, you think of someone like Colson Whitehead. Colson Whitehead's first book was The Intuitionist. Absolutely phenomenal. Really sort of out of left field. Very sort of strange book.
Big buzz.
His second book was John Henry Days. And it was ambitious, right? But it wasn't as good as his first one. And then he kind of... You know, he sort of gets positioned in a sort of a weird way and does some nonfiction, then comes back with a really skinny novel, and he's still around.
Hmm.
You know, but you're waiting for that. I mean, even someone like Jonathan Lethem took a long time to get going. Michael Chabon didn't really sort of explode until Cavalier and Clay. I mean, people liked his books, but.
I feel really sorry, though, for some of these first-time authors who have this kind of marketing muscle behind their books, because then it's time to write their sophomore book.
Yeah.
And it's stressful.
Yeah.
How can you measure up? You're under a tremendous amount of stress. Like Tom Rockman's The Imperfectionist, this was his debut novel. And I think he has a second book, a novella. Has anybody heard of it? No.
No, not yet.
Because he had the sophomore slump.
No, and I have a couple. I've heard of writer friends who their first book did well and – so the company's waiting for the second book, and they decide to do something different from the first book. And the company's like, I'll tell you what, we'll give you money to not publish that book.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. And that's the kind of stuff where, you know, it's a hyper-competitive marketplace. And
well, to listen to our movie critics when they're in here, they will say the same thing about films. Either you hit a film that makes 100 mil plus – or forget it. The movie houses aren't interested in $50 million, $60 million films. They want the big ones.
Well, and I think, I mean, to me at least, I think that the decrease in the amount of basically criticism, right? I mean, there's still book critics, and book critics are still doing their thing, but it's not on the same level. There's not as many sort of outlets.
Well, everybody's a critic now with the internet.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I think that... You know, you could have a novel that maybe wasn't getting much attention from a house. Maybe they like give it $10,000-$15,000 in a marketing campaign, which would be a couple ads. But if you get a critical mass, so you get reviewed in The Star, and then you get picked up, a good review in Chicago, a good review in Milwaukee, a good review in Cleveland, all of a sudden, right, the company's like, oh, we'll put some more money behind this book.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
But, I mean, there are authors being published by university presses. My husband being one.
Well, Jeff, let's come to you here. Your first one is Where'd You Go, Bernadette by Maria Semple.
That's right. Where'd You Go, Bernadette, without a question mark.
No question mark.
No question mark. The Bernadette by Maria Semple. This book is going to be published tomorrow by Little Brown, and I had a review of it in the Kansas City Star. And the Bernadette of the title is an agoraphobic architect who disappears on the eve of a family trip to Antarctica. And speaking of sort of balancing electronics with conventional narrative, the first two-thirds of the book is comprised, it's narrated by Bernadette's 15-year-old daughter, but the first two-thirds is like email exchanges, psychiatric reports, various faux documents. It's sort of the epistolary novel translated into the electronic age. And the last third is pretty much a first-person narration plus a missing missive from the mom. And I actually like the last part best. But at any rate, I would very much recommend this. Maria Semple's first book was This One Is Mine, which was a send-up of Los Angeles. And this is a send-up of her adopted city of Seattle. And she is wickedly satiric. She knows no sacred cows. She satirizes clogs. She satirizes gray hair. She satirizes TED Talks. She satirizes helicopter parents, whom she calls Subaru parents. She satirizes the gifted child industry. And if you happen to own a Subaru and have a child in the gifted program, ouch, which I do. So, but
it is an industry.
She's not only wickedly satiric, but also funny and tender, and I like that aspect of her better. And what she's funny and tender about is the family here. Bernadette, who had a brilliant start to her career, got a MacArthur Genius Grant, and then suffered a humiliation in Los Angeles and decamped for Seattle with her Microsoft guru husband, who is a genius, who is working on a robot that will be controlled by human impulses to the brain, and B, their precocious and generous daughter. But if Bernadette has disappeared, which she has on the eve of the trip to Antarctica, and which she did from her architecture career, her husband, LG, has long ago disappeared in his work at Microsoft, just his all-consuming work. The last part of the book occurs around in and around the White Continent of Antarctica, and the family's problems kind of shrink in comparison to the beauty and the majesty of the natural surroundings, and I really loved the last part of the book. Maria Simple, in Los Angeles, now lives in Seattle, used to live in Los Angeles, and write for Arrested Development, Mad About You, Ellen. Lots of laugh-out-loud moments, lots of quirky plot twists. I didn't just love it as much as her first novel, but I liked it a lot, and it's getting raves. It's got a blurb from Jonathan Franz in here. I tore through this book with heedless pleasure. Tons of very stellar recommendations, and so I would very much recommend it.
So there's a sophomore writer who's succeeding, you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah,
you're right.
There you go. That's Where'd You Go, Bernadette by Maria Simple. Okay. Mark Luce, you have some oldies but goodies here you want to kick off with.
In just a couple weeks, I'm teaching a class at the University of Kansas on crime fiction from 1840 to 1915.
Wow.
So it's like arch villains and detection. And while 30s and 40s noir is really more my speed, over the years I've become more and more intrigued with like how detection and policing sort of starts. And so in that vein, I brought a pair of books, one extremely well-known and one probably not so well-known.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I have here is the complete original illustrated Sherlock Holmes. So it has all the Sherlock Holmes stories that, and they're basically reprints from the Strand magazine. So they have little pictures and stuff. And we all know Holmes, like you know who he is. But we tend to think of him more from what we see on television or what we saw in the movies. And Holmes is peculiar. He's a master of disguise. Everything is told through his friend Watson sort of documents all of these exploits. Sometimes he has trouble with opiates occasionally. And he sits and
yeah,
who doesn't? he does the kind of things that you would tend to think. He solves crime. Now, Doyle's sister married a fellow named E.W. Hornig. And E.W. Hornig created a character named Raffles. And Raffles is a gentleman thief. And Raffles' story is told by his friend Harry Masters, whose nickname is Bunny. And Bunny comes to Raffles one night. He's lost all his money at the baccarat table and threatens to kill himself. And Raffles talks him out of it because they went to school together. And he's like, I'll help you if you help me. And he's like, okay. And they go and rob a jewelry store. And so in this way, it starts. Raffles is a spectacular batsman in cricket. He's very well known all over town, but no one knows that he has this sort of side project of ripping people off. And he tends to rip off people who are overly smug, right, or haughty, and then he tries to get them. And Bunny, the guy who's telling the story, constantly is like, I shouldn't be doing this, I shouldn't be doing this, I shouldn't be doing this, but I'm going to do this anyway. And so they're very fun, and it's a nice counterpoint to the Holmes. I mean, they're pretty much the same thing, just on the opposite side of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in both cases, right, I mean, there are they're products of their time, and at times there are things you know, culturally or racially that might not
fit today's times. Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm.
However, you just, mm-hmm. you know, you, I sort of acknowledge it and then move past it. But they're both, the Holmes stories are great. And a lot of them you already know. And the Raffles stories, it's just kind of a kick in the pants.
Are the Holmes stories as good today as they were for readers back in the early part of the last century and when it was so hot and you know, so widely read?
Boy, howdy. I don't know. You know, the thing that I notice is that people who read Holmes as a kid, you know, between, you know, say 10 and 16,
yeah.
Are pretty much, I mean, I guess obsessed is probably not strong enough of a word.
Yeah. There's a whole culture yeah. sort of around
well,
those books.
And new
yeah.
and people write new stories and they have all kinds of different stuff and they have meetings. But, you know, I think that part of the reason that it became so popular was the way in which it was distributed, right? It's distributed in a magazine that everybody reads, and so you're waiting. And there's a sort of episodic quality to it.
Yeah.
It's like, what's going to happen next? What's in the next episode? And so I don't think – I think now it doesn't have that.
But the stories hold up, though.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are – I mean, at times they're – you know, some are more corny than others, but mm-hmm. yeah, they, I mean, they're fun.
Yeah.
And there's not really anything to gripe about. It's like, oh, well, he wouldn't have done that. It's Sherlock Holmes. He's smart. And Watson is funny. Watson's just, because Holmes always makes fun of him and Watson just kind of takes it, you know, or he'll disappear. Holmes will disappear. Like, where were you?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I've had that edition in my hands at like Half Price Books 10 times. I just haven't bought it yet, but I have been close.
You know, the only bad thing about this edition is it's big.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're reading in bed, as I often do, it has a tendency to hit you on the head
yeah.
when you start nodding off.
Yeah, I hear
and,
you. I hear you.
And then your spouse will laugh at you.
Yeah.
That's pretty much.
Grace, let's go to your first pick here, Half Empty, by an author who died just last week, right?
Oh, well, can I go back?
You can go back.
Okay.
Yeah.
I actually want to start with Arlington Park.
Okay, you'll save the big suspense for later.
I will. Yeah. I will. I spent the summer in Chile, Maine, and interestingly, I spent the summer reading Chile English authors. So I read a lot of Claire Massoud, whom, if we have time, I'll talk about later, and David Mitchell, who I'll talk about later. And I also read Rachel Cusk, who is, I think, relatively unknown here in America, but is a really big name in England, one of the top writers. And anything she does gets a lot of press in The Guardian and The Independent.
Yeah.
And part of that is because she's a fabulous writer, and she gets fabulous reviews, and also because she is merciless in her dissection of modern life, including her own life. So her most recent book, which is about her divorce and really, you know, too much information, I think would most people agree. And the book before that was about having babies, and that again was too much information.
Wow.
And she's just a person who puts it all out there. But the thing that makes it readable is that she's an extremely intelligent and elegant writer. And she reminds me a lot of John Updike sometimes in the precision and poetry of her descriptions, the physical descriptions, the metaphysical descriptions. And so she's just a real pleasure to read. It's very poetic. And then at the same time, you're gasping. You're saying, I can't believe she said that. So
yeah.
This book that I read this summer is called Arlington Park. And to make it relatable to us here in Kansas City, and to dumb it down a little, because, you know, we're Americans, and we don't like things way over our heads like they like it in England. You could call it Desperate Housewives of Johnson County, because Arlington Park is a suburb, is an affluent suburb of London. And it's a dissection of the lives of all of these people who live there. And it's interrelated stories, kind of like A Visit from the Goon Squad. These you'll read from the point of view of one woman, and there'll be other women in the background, and then you'll switch, and now you're reading from the point of view of
mm-hmm.
one of those secondary characters. And so it gives this prismatic effect. You never really know where you're going to go. You're kind of trying to pay attention because you realize that, oh, this woman whom she hates, now we're reading from her point of view, and she thinks she's her best friend. And so there's a lot of that. I guess that's the Desperate Housewives quality. But again, they're really beautifully structured and really beautifully written. And so you don't feel like you're reading a lot of gossip, but you kind of are.
Yeah. That book is Arlington Park by Rachel Cusk, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I can't say that. I think that if you're familiar with, you know, with motherhood or the domestic life, it's something that's interesting to read. Is it uplifting? No, it is not uplifting.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our book doctors. We'll get to The Last Good Man, No Life for a Lady, and The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet.
Does it?
I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's talk about the cultural history of flab, otherwise known as fat, or commentator Victor Wishna's latest installment of A Fan's Notes, you'll find them at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, writer Malcolm Garcia tells us about his recent visit to Afghanistan. Also, journalist John Hockenberry talks with us about living with a disability and his career as a public radio host. But this hour, we're visiting with our book doctors, Katie Stover, Jeff Gowdy, Mark Luce, and Grace Suh. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation with your recommendations for a good read that perhaps you're in the midst of right now, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Up-to-date at kcur.org is our email address, where we can go to KCUR's Facebook page. Katie Stover, let's go to The Art Forger by B.A. Shapiro.
This is another book that will be published in October, and this is another galley that I picked up at Book Expo America in June, and I just fell in love with this book. It's a wonderful story. It's got interesting characters. It's from Algonquin. It's getting that, I mentioned before, it's getting that debut type of a push, but no one is using the word debut, and they can't because it's by B.A. Shapiro, who has published as Barbara Shapiro for Four Mysteries, and then was dropped from her publisher and picked up by Algonquin. This is very different from her previous Four Mysteries. And it asks the question, where does art's value lie, and when is a lie a work of art? Because it's part mystery. Where did 13 works of art worth over $500 million end up after a heist at the Gardner Museum in Boston? And they've never resurfaced after more than 20 years. And it's part tangled romance because Claire, this fledgling artist, is making the ultimate sacrifice for her artist lover. She inspires and paints one of his greatest works before his untimely death. And he sells it to a very well-known museum and never tells that he's not the artist. And then she questions the authenticity of the painting. This apparently is not something that you do in art circles. You either, because somebody's reputation is about to get ruined and some museum is about to get egg all over their face for paying a lot for a painting. So Grace's or Claire's reputation is in tatters, and she becomes someone who makes reproductions. And this is a thriving industry in the art world. And she is brought an original Degas and recognizes it as one that was stolen from the Gardner Museum. And she's told, no, no, not an original. You're just going to make another reproduction of this reproduction. And she starts investigating. And she finds out that, yes, it is a painting that was hanging in the Gardner Museum during that heist. But then she discovers that the painting hanging in the Gardner Museum was a forgery. So the Degas that they had was a forgery. And this book just begins to twist in on itself the mysteries of this missing art collection. What is a forgery? What is not? What is the Gardner Museum going to do if they had purchased a forgery that they've had for years?
Is this fiction or nonfiction?
It's fiction. It's based on the one historical aspect of it is there was a heist at the Gardner Museum in Boston. Happened a little more than 20 years ago. Yeah. And the paintings have never been recovered. Right. Never been recovered. She speculates where the paintings are at the end. No one really finds out. But I think this is a book that book groups are going to have a lot of fun with because it's got interesting characters. It's got a really speedy plot, which you typically see in a debut novel, but it's got that character development that we like to see in follow-up books. And it's not really a question of art, but who decides what is art? And to whom does the art belong? Does it belong to the artist? Does it belong to the museum that purchased it? Does it belong to the viewer? So I found this to be just a compelling read.
That certainly sounds up my alley. There's a book, and I'm not going to remember the title, nor am I going to remember the author, but I'm going to try my best. There was a book written by a former FBI agent who dealt with forgeries and art heists, and he had a team of dudes. And one of the things that they constantly tried to do was to find out where these Gardner pieces had disappeared to. They actually had a series of meetings with, you know, ne'er-do-wells and shady characters, thinking they had a bead on one of those paintings. But that might be a good companion piece to that. I'll figure it out here in the next few minutes, and then we can say it at the
end. I would love to know that. That would be a wonderful pairing for a book group. Read a nonfiction, read a fiction. And I went looking for all sorts of info on this art crime. It's, you know, tickled the back of my memory, and it's fascinating stuff.
That's The Art Forger by B.A. Shapiro, and we'll have a list of all these books we're talking about today up on our website later on today. Jeff, how about No Life for a Lady?
Okay. I want to
refer... Not your life, by the way. But, nothing out of biography.
Actually, my life is No Life for a Lady. That is true. So it would Life for a Woman. But anyway, returning to something Grace said about she kind of felt a little maybe guilty, like she was reading gossip. Who was it who said that fiction is just elevated gossip? So if you can remember... Tell me. Mm-hmm. This is actually nonfiction, No Life for a Lady by Agnes Morley Cleveland. And it was first brought out in 1941 by Houghton Mifflin. And it's a memoir of early ranch and cattle ranch life in New Mexico. And then it was brought out as a paperback in 1977 by Bison Books. And it's still taught in Western history classes and women's history classes. And Agnes Cleveland's dad was a civil engineer who was involved in such big projects as connecting Colorado and New Mexico, the Raton Pass. He was also the editor of the Cimarron newspaper. And she was born in 1874, so we're talking about, you know, the last part of one century and the turn of the next. And anyway, he was killed in a gun accident. People packed their six shooters back there and their rifles, and he was accidentally killed. And her mother was a very refined and kind of impractical person who married a charmer. And the charmer spent most of the family fortune on cattle and land in New Mexico. He pretty quickly disappeared, and Agnes's impractical mother is left with the ranch and with her three children, Agnes, Ray, and Laura. And this is back in the day when kids had a heck of a lot of freedom. You know, it's amazing what these kids are running around shooting six shooters. They had as much responsibility as they did freedom. For example, anything that needed to be done, they'd say, put the kid on the horse, send him out to do that. And every week, no matter what the weather, no matter how much ice there was, they went and collected the mail, which is a 20-mile horseback ride. Mm. And Agnes developed into quite a horsewoman. She could cut a cow out of the herd. She, at one point, a weekly newspaper said she was the best rider in the county next to Three Finger Pete. And this was done, too, when she was riding side saddle, because it was only in later years that she got brave enough to wear split skirts. They had a lot of hair-raising adventures, which they survived by their wits and by their physical prowess. I think maybe my favorite chapter in the book is where she goes with a British neighbor on a grizzly hunt. He has organized a hunt, and Frederick Remington, the artist, is going on it, and an army general is going on it, and the army general is promoted to chief of staff, and it falls apart, and Agnes gets to go along on the grizzly hunt, and she is riding horses on mountain ridges, and she's scampering up a tree. She's one intrepid person. She went on to Stanford University and married a fellow Stanford student. Her brother, Ray Morley, became an early football star in Columbia University, was the captain of the football team, but he came back to run the ranch. I read this when we were at our family cabin in the Pecos wilderness, so it kind of deepened that experience, you know. And that, so we ran out of water, couldn't take a shower. It's like, heck, this is nothing.
So this is nonfiction.
Yeah, this is nonfiction. Yeah. And like I said, this is still taught as recommended reading in Western history and women's history classes, so I would very much recommend it. I looked online. There are all kinds of copies available by Abe Books and on Amazon, so it's still available. So No Life for a Lady.
Agnes Marley Cleveland.
Morley Cleveland, yeah.
Okay, very good. Mark Luce, All the Pretty Horses?
Yeah, actually I have a back-to-school pair. Mm-hmm. So All the Pretty Horses, which is going to certainly will fit in with No Life for a Lady, and Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, which is coming out as a film, but they pushed it back until the spring because it was going to come out at Christmas time.
The Great Gatsby?
Yeah, with Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby.
Oh, sure.
Tobey Maguire
as Nick.
As Nick. And
who's
I don't know.
Daisy?
Oh,
how many times has this book been made into a movie?
Not
one.
Recently, though.
No, it's been done before.
No.
Yeah, Redford and...
Redford
and...
And Mia Farrow.
Mia Farrow, yeah.
Yeah. But we'll start with... So these are the kind of books that kids have to read for summer reading.
Like, yeah.
It's kind of wherever you go. And I recently reread both of them. And surprisingly, they actually work quite well together. Gatsby is a story of a Midwesterner moving toward the East and sort of falling into sort of moral and spiritual despair and corruption, whereas All the Pretty Horses is about a young man who travels west, or in this case, southwest, in order to find some sort of hope in a world that is increasingly shrinking for him. One of the things, I mean, a lot of people have certainly read Gatsby, but one of the things that I found most interesting is early in the novel, Nick says that he's the most honest man that he knows. And as you read it, you realize that he's lying. He's not really an honest man. He's really kind of a cad.
Hmm.
And this time that I read it, he was much more of a cad than I had remembered from reading it a couple of years ago. I think the book holds up wonderfully, and you know, when you read Fitzgerald, the richness of his prose just sort of washes over you.
What makes this book a classic?
Well, it's a rags to riches story, and it's the sort of the outsider watching it happen, and you see the sort of moral decay of the elite in New York in the 20s. I mean, it really sort of captures that, like, oh, we're flying so high and everything's great and we've got cool jewelry and we have all these things, and then it all just collapses.
Mm-hmm.
With McCarthy, John Grady's going, his grandfather has passed and his mom's going to sell the 25,000 acre family farm, and he wants to run it, but he wants to be a horseman, so he goes head south to Mexico, and this is right after the war. World War II, and he goes with a friend, and they meet up with this little kid who causes all kinds of trouble. In some ways, it's a love story. In some ways, it's a survivalist story. you could liken it to Huckleberry Finn in some ways, but it's really a story of sort of frontiers and sort of moving to frontiers and also coming of age. And so they're actually kind of a nice – they sort of play off each other in kind of interesting ways that I really hadn't, you know, I never would think to pair these two books.
And you had your kids read these this summer?
No, I actually read them with a colleague of mine. We did a little book discussion, and these are the books we chose.
Yeah.
And so it took a while. We're like, okay, how do these work together?
Mm-hmm.
But we figured it out. For me, the seniors in AP English read All the Pretty Horses and DeLillo's Mao Tu, and then the juniors at Barstow read The Great Gatsby in American Lit.
What's the controlling metaphor of The Great Gatsby? I'm having a senior moment. You know, the light.
Oh, there's the green light.
The green light.
The green light is the hope on the end, right? Yeah. And Gatsby mistakenly thinking that, what does he say? Nick tells him he can't repeat the past. He's like, of course you can. And you're like, oh, Jay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You idiot. And then the eyes of T.J. Eccleburg over the
right.
over the
and a lot
of
green. It's not just the green light, but the green lawn that goes up against mm-hmm. the side of the house and right. just this endless green, endless money.
Yes. Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with our book doctors, going through a bunch of good books, good recommendations. They'll be up on our website later on today, KCUR.org. Let's see. Grace, how about where are you going to go here? Half empty?
No, I'm going to go to – I'm just going to really, keep on deferring.
You're really
you.
Saving it something, aren't you? The Thousand
well, this,
Autumns.
Well, this is a big one. It's this was my saga for the summer. It's 500 pages, but it feels like more, not because it's slow reading, but because it is action-packed. And I had been wanting to read David Mitchell for a while because he gets – again, he's a British author, and in England he is – big. He is gigantic. He's way bigger than Jonathan Franzen is here, really. He's a finalist for the Booker. He's gotten prizes for every book he's written. Mm-hmm. And yet I've never wanted to read him because he's his purview thus far has been kind of metaphysical fantasy, and that is not me. You know, I saw The Matrix, but I did not see 2 and 3. And it, I think the books have been kind of like that. They're so popular that one of them, Cloud Atlas, is coming out in October as a movie directed, speaking of The Matrix, by the Wachowski, well, formerly brothers, now siblings. And because one of them had a gender change.
Oh.
And starring Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Hugh Grant, Susan Sarandon, my favorite Korean actress, Beduna. And it's going to be this big, you know, it's a big spectacular fall release. And so this guy is big. But again, he's never really been in my alley until this book, which is a book about the meeting of East and West. So it's a saga set in the 1700s of the last Dutch trading company in Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
They're limited to a little man-made island. They cannot go onto the actual land because Japan has forbidden all foreigners. And so they're in this little prison. And the only time they get off is when the Dutch ship comes in once a year. And the rest of the time, they're confined to, you know, 2 blocks by 2 blocks. And so this is the story of these people who are on this island, and all of this stuff happens there. There's a lot of translation going on. To give you a little background, David Mitchell lived in Japan for many years. He's married to a Japanese woman, and he's written this, you know, speaking as an Asian American, he has done a really great job of giving you the viewpoint not only of the Western encroachers, but the Japanese and how they see the Westerners. And there's a lot of translation going on here, which I think is really fascinating. All the things that get lost in translation and this is a big business. There's an entire league of translators whose job is to learn Dutch so that they can work with these traders.
Yeah.
And the book is separated into 3 sections, and then the middle section gets insanely gothic. I was reading it, and I thought, well, I mostly read literary fiction, and so I don't usually read stuff like this. And it ran away from me, and I kept thinking, am I reading this book? What's going on? Where all of a sudden, one of the characters is kidnapped and is sent away to this monastery where the nuns are being used for nefarious sexual purposes, and their offspring are being used as human sacrifice. And I'm thinking, wow, I haven't read a book like this since I was 12 years old. and yet it all ties together. And then all of a sudden, in the third act, in the last 150 pages, there's a huge historical surprise with an invasion by yet another Western country. I'll save it for you, Steve, so that I don't ruin the book. And then it all comes together, and it was a page turner. I mean, I was literally every night slamming my kids into bed so I could read another 20 pages. And it's, I think, really rare to get a book that's so literary,
yeah,
and yet such a, you know, on a very high level, and yet such a page turner. Yeah, it was really fun. And at the end, I thought, you know, it's no Great Gatsby, but it was a fun 500.
And the
pages.
Title again is?
The title is The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet.
By David Mitchell.
Great whose movie is coming out in October.
Yeah, okay.
There aren't really enough fun literary books. like Chabon like Chabon can write comedy pretty well, and yeah. his language is gorgeous. But you think about like serious fiction writers, and the comedy is just not.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it kind of not fun. Yeah.
Yeah, or the plot. After this, I'm going to be reading Hilary Mantel. I've decided that this is my fall of Hilary Mantel, so I'm going to do Wolf Hall because, again, I think that will be very plot-driven.
We just have a few minutes left, gang. Let's scoot on here. Katie Stover, The Last Good Man.
Oh, this is a translation. It's also a debut by A.J. Kaczynski.
Mm-hmm.
And it revolves it's a mystery that revolves around the Jewish legend that the world is kept from destruction by 36 good, just people who are unaware of their status. And there's someone going around the world and killing 1 through 36 of these people. And these two detectives who don't know each other, one is headquartered in Venice, Tommaso Di Barbera. He discovers this is what's going on. He learns that this is the series of crimes. And he contacts a Danish colleague who he's never met, Niels Bentzen, to assist him. They need to find the last two people.
Hmm.
Who are the last of the 236. And Niels hooks up with Hannah Lund. She's a kind of crazy science savant. And she's the one that discovers the pattern. It's a real page-turner. There's some metaphysics working here. You learn an awful lot about the universe and how it works, this Jewish legend, and how the legend works with science. And Hannah is just one of those geniuses that just seems to float off into her mathematical, metaphysical world. And the reader kind of is following it. And then when you don't, just when you think, where is she going? You don't need to worry about that because Neil says, Hannah, where are we supposed to go? Knock it off. And
yeah.
So it's really neat to listen to because just about the time I'm drifting off thinking, where is she going? Niels pops in and says, that's enough. Let's just get where we need to go. So it's a thriller that's very strong on characters. The plot's what will keep you, but it's the characters that are really interesting, especially the protagonists.
That's The Last Good Man by A.J. Kaczynski, right?
A.J. Kaczynski.
Jeff, how about The Imperfectionist by Tom Rockman?
Yeah. Did you read this, Steve, by any chance? It's a journalism book.
I think you'd
really like it.
Yeah.
This was a very much talked about book of a couple of years ago, a debut novel, Tom Rockman's The Imperfectionist. And it's the story of an English language newspaper in Rome in its declining days. It was started in 19...
Oh, boy. Yeah. No wonder I didn't read it. Yeah.
It was started in 1954, but it's 2007, and the readership of the paper, the circulation of the paper has dwindled to 10,000 readers as the internet has stolen readers, advertising, and made everybody a critic and a reporter, and it's all for free. But this story, the chronicle of the paper, is told by various characters who work for the paper, the Paris correspondent, the obituary writer, the business reporter, the corrections editor, and anybody who's been in the newspaper industry will recognize and resonate with the corrections editor who really cares about the difference between that and which, and possibly also the remote publisher. This is a family empire who's so many generations down the line that he doesn't even read the newspaper. He uses it as lining, you know, for whatever. But anyway, Tom Rockman was a foreign correspondent for AP and also an editor for the International Herald Tribune in Paris. And he has said that he often felt really shipwrecked by the demands that are put on a daily journalist day by day.
Mm.
How much you're supposed to do, how fast you're supposed to do it, and you're always supposed to be correct. But
now we're talking about Steve Kraske's
inner... Steve's like,
why
Steve's
do I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning here? Yes, now you know. Yeah.
But although he says he felt really daunted and he's no longer a daily journalist. He writes about that world with great affection.
Oh, I can't wait to read this book, Jeff. Yeah, jeez. That's The Imperfectionist by Tom Rockman.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Jeff.
Jeff, commas, which cut out the fat, go with which and not with that.
Yes, I know that.
Okay, all right.
I have
that's an important
and actually it's really important to me, too. And who and whom and all the rest.
Non-essential phrases are separated by commas and use which.
Yeah.
Essential goes with that.
Yeah.
Tell us about The City of Glass, Mark Luke.
It was a wrong number that started it. That's how the book begins. This version of City of Glass is a novel by Paul Auster, which is fun. It's basically a postmodern detective story where a guy who has lost his family gets a phone call saying, is this Paul Auster? and he needs him to the detective, and he says, no, it's not. And then he waits, and the next time that the person calls, he says, yes, it is. And so he takes on being a detective to help this follow a man who's getting out of prison,
mm-hmm.
Who has raised his son in sort of a strange way. The one that I had, I used this summer in a graphic novels class at KU, is a graphic adaptation of it by Paul Karasik and David Mazzucchelli, who wrote Asterios Polyp. And it lends itself very well. The novel lends itself very well to graphic adaptation. It's strange, and it has a very open ending. But if you like, if you like Auster, you'll love it. Auster, I think, for a lot of people, is an acquired taste. Getting a thumbs down over here
from Grace.
The New York trilogy is sort of his most famous, and City of Glass is the lead one of that.
You get about 45 seconds for Grace to tell us about David Rakoff and Half Empty, finally.
I have this book here called Half Empty, Steve.
Yes, there you go.
David Rakoff died last week, and I happened to read this book this summer, and I recommend it. He also wrote Fraud, which I love, but this is my favorite because it is the most autobiographical, and it is not just clever. It is actually I just kept thinking it's so true.
Wow. So true
about life and what it means to be a real person. And I think that's what makes him so funny, kind of not to compare him to David Sedaris and put David Sedaris in a bad light, but these aren't just funny stories. I feel like the reason he's so funny is because he dares to say things that that probably you shouldn't about what it means to live an authentic life. And I think it really moved me to have read this book and feel that he had said so much about life and then to know that he died last week.
Well, what a good set of recommendations. Thank you for that one, Grace, and thank you all for coming in today.
Thanks
always good to have
us.
You guys. Yeah.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Our book doctors again today, Katie Stover of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, Mark Luce of the Barstow School, blogger and editor Grace Suh, and author and critic Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Again, a list of all their selections are on our website, kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, writer Malcolm Garcia tells us about his recent trip to Afghanistan. Also, public radio host John Hockenberry. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date. Thank you.